Well, we're trying to make a tree that we actually want to put back into the forest. And they're so used to having a crop that they're trying to keep on the field. But we actually want this gene to go out and rescue other trees.
We've researched this. We've done a lot of work on it. We've tested this. It's 39 years of research, so it's not something that they should be scared of.
It's my job to keep track of around 5,000 trees that we're responsible for taking care of.
But it's not going to happen fast. I should mention that chestnut's not a weed. It will not spread quickly. This is restoration is what I call a 100-year project.
Dr. Powell is a real-life Lorax, and he does speak for the trees.
Hello, this is ESF President Joni Mahoney, back for our Campus Conversation, the podcast. And I am joined by Dr. William Powell, Linda McGuigan, and Kira Lowe-Piccolo. And we are talking today about tree restoration and resiliency with a focus on the American chestnut. This has been a series of fascinating conversations with ESF faculty, staff, and students about research that's done here at ESF. And one of our most popular projects is led by you, Bill. So can you introduce yourself to the audience?
Yes, I'm Bill Powell. I'm the director of the American Chestnut Research and Restoration Project. Started here in 1989, so quite a few years. And that's actually the year we started the project, myself and Dr. Charles Maynard. Charles has since retired, but the project goes on and made great progress over these years.
Tell the audience about the American chestnut tree and its historical importance to us in the United States in particular.
So the American chestnut once was a very common tree, especially in the Appalachian Mountains and all the way up through into central New York. It was what's called a keystone species. It provided food and shelter for many different wildlife species. Also for people, it provided a very rot-resistant wood. It provided an annual nut crop that people would sell. In fact, our first dean of the College of ESF, Bray Hall, is named after William Bray, used to write about trees. And one of the things he said about the American chestnut was that some farmers actually got more income from the chestnut harvest than from any other farm product. And that's because on their land, they had all these wild trees. They just had to go out, collect the nuts, bring them in and sell them. It's like manna from heaven, you know, it's just free crop and provided them an extra income. But we lost all that. And we lost all that because of an exotic pathogen that was introduced a little over 100 years ago that basically wiped out 3 to 4 billion of these trees.
I had chestnut trees around where I lived in the 1970s and 80s. They probably weren't American chestnut. Is that right?
That is true. Most people confuse the American chestnut with the horse chestnut. And there's lots of horse chestnuts out there. Very nice tree. It's great for things like hummingbirds. And of course, they produce those nuts that everybody fights with in the fall, you know, all the kids do. But that is a different species of tree. It's not the one that we are trying to restore.
I think that's important because many times when I've talked to people about the American chestnut tree, they mistakenly think that it's that horse chestnut tree. So you came here to ESF. Was this project already started, or are you and Dr. Maynard responsible for starting that project?
Well, Dr. Maynard and I did start the project here, but we do have a history with the American chestnut. Back in the 1950s, there was a collaboration with the Connecticut Experiment Station where they were planting hybrids and Chinese chestnuts and seeing how they would do in our forest. And actually at our Lafayette Road Experiment Station was one of their planting sites. And so we had chestnuts there in the 1950s. There might be one or two still surviving today, but pretty much they have not survived.
So this American chestnut tree suffered blight, but it didn't completely ruin the tree genetics because at a certain point close to the ground, the blight wasn't affecting it?
Yes. So the blight basically enters a wound in the tree. The chestnut blights are caused by a fungus, and it forms a canker, kills everything above that canker. But when it gets down to the ground, the microbes in the soil can outcompete that fungus and therefore it protects the roots. And the chestnut has this ability to sprout from the root collar. So it gets killed down to the ground, it sprouts from the root collar, it will grow for a while, but then gets killed back down again. So it's like a Sisyphus cycle where you're kind of going through these cycles of killing and renewing and killing and renewing. So there's still probably a few million stumps in the forest. And that's a good thing because that allows us to have enough genetic diversity to bring this tree back.
And the killing off of the tree happens before it is viable for the hardwood that you described or the feedstock or that crop that farmers were getting wealthy selling.
That is true. Most of the time, these sprouts die before they ever reach maturity, so they do not produce nuts. Obviously, they don't get big enough to make a wood product anymore, but at least they're surviving. They haven't gone extinct. We call it functionally extinct because they're not having all the benefits they had in the past, but they are still around.
What did you start with when you were trying to see if you could rescue this American chestnut tree?
The American Chestnut Foundation, they came to us in 1989 and asked, can we produce a blight-resistant tree? And Dr. Maynard and I looked at our backgrounds and stuff like that, and then we said, well, it probably could. It probably take over 10 years to do that, and it did. So they kind of initiated. So it was kind of like a public request to work on this tree. So what we did was we looked at, first of all, what kind of genes might confer resistance to the blight? And then how do you actually get these genes in the tree? I always say we had to build the ship before we went fishing. So we had to actually develop the techniques to get the genes into the tree and then start testing genes.
So you looked at the existing gene pool of the American chestnut. You knew what the fungus was that was causing the blight. And then you went to work to try to find genetic material that could make that tree resistant to the blight so it could thrive?
Yes. So we understood how the fungus attacked a tree. And one of the major ways it attacks it by producing this acid called oxalic acid. And so what we look for is some kind of gene that can neutralize that acid. And we actually found it in an unusual place. We found it in wheat. And this is actually a ubiquitous gene. It's in wheat, it's in a lot of different plants. But this gene will detoxify that acid that the fungus makes and therefore removes that weapon. And therefore the tree can survive. So all we had to do is take that gene and then put it in the chestnut, have it make that enzyme, and then the tree would coexist with the fungus.
And you found this about 10 years into your research?
It might have been a little bit more than 10 years because, again, we had to first develop all the techniques, and this was done mainly in Dr. Maynard's lab, all the techniques that it takes to regenerate a tree from a single cell. A lot of work went into that. And then once we could do that, then we had to test genes. And we tested lots of different genes and finally came to this one for the oxalate oxidase.
It's interesting and important to note that this is a gene that is in the wheat that we're eating in our bread.
Absolutely. It's in wheat. You eat it every day. Matter of fact, it's in a lot of different plants. It's in bananas. So if you had bananas for breakfast, you ate some oxalate oxidase. It's in almost every grain you can find. The problem is this is that chestnut did not have that. So we gave the chestnut its ability to now detoxify that acid.
And I think that becomes important later in the story too. So back now to where we are. So you and this team that you have here with you, you can't just take one of these stumps and figure out how to get the gene in there and then that thrives. Maybe this is where you come into the story, Linda. How do you take that and then end up with a seedling that we can plant?
So we start with American chestnut embryos, and we have to get them into plant tissue culture. So we go to the field and we get immature nuts from wild type trees, and we bring them into the lab and we sterilize them using a bleaching process. We cut open the nuts and then we extract the embryos. We put them on a medium that has nutrients for the embryos to grow and multiply, and it's a clonal process. So once we have them multiplying, we use a bacterium called Agrobacteria. And this is a natural genetic engineer. It's in the soil by plants. It normally causes galls in plants. And scientists have been able to unarm it and take that gall-producing gene out. And we've put the oxalate oxidase gene into the bacterium, and the bacterium is mixed with the embryos, and then the bacterium will actually transfer the gene over to the plant cell.
It's fascinating. You were able to find a nut. So where did that nut come from?
Not all chestnut trees are dead, and some of them are able to get big enough to produce flowers and pollinate and and produce nuts. So we have a bunch of wild type trees in our orchards, and we're able to collect the nuts from there.
And then you cut that open and get this embryo, and that's the process where you add the gene from the wheat.
Right.
And what happens after it does what it's supposed to do in your lab?
We grow the agrobacterium up in a liquid medium, so it has nutrients for the bacterium and it grows up. We mix it together with the embryos. We let it sit for a few days together, and then we will put it in another medium that has antibiotics that will kill off any non-transformed cells, and it also kills off the agrobacterium. Once we know we have one of these cells that survive the process, we will regenerate it into a new shoot, and we will test to make sure the gene is in there, test to see how many copies of the gene was put in there, because sometimes there's more than one gene. And we want to see the expression level. So we'll check to see how much relative expression that it's making. And then we root it and do some more testing.
I can't imagine the eureka moment when you realized this is working. What was that point?
Well, it actually started when we first discovered the oxidase gene. It was one of our postdocs from ESF had just returned from a plant physiology conference. And back in those days, they still had those books of abstracts that you got from the conference. And she lent it to me, and I was just leafing through it. And I came across this abstract where these people were using this gene called oxidase in tomatoes. And I thought, you know, this is an interesting gene, because I remember as a graduate student working on the chestnut blight, that oxalic acid was how the blight attacked a tree. And it's just like, put the one and one together to get two, eureka. And said, that's the gene we need to go after. So we contacted the person who wrote that abstract. They sent us a copy of the gene. We started putting them in vectors that we could put into the chestnut, and went through, and it didn't work as well at first. So it's like we had lots of different versions. The first ones we put in, we say the tree died slower. Okay. But that showed us we were on the right track. Then we had some that we had intermediate levels of resistance, which means that they were more resistant than the American chestnut, but not as resistant as Chinese chestnut, which is our standard control for resistance. And then later, we finally had some that were just as resistant as the control trees.
I can't imagine what that feeling must have been. And Kira, what an opportunity for you. So you're an undergraduate student here, is that right?
Yes, I'm a senior in the biotechnology program. But my time with Dr. Powell and his team started in 2016 when I was a high school student.
How did that come about?
So my AP biology teacher is an ESF alum, and every summer he sends a couple students from his biology classes to work with Dr. Powell and his team as interns for the summer. And I asked him every day, I said, please pick me. Please, please, I just want to get the opportunity to be in a real science lab. And me and another student got to spend the entire summer being almost real scientists.
What an opportunity. And that's one of the things ESF is known for, is research opportunities at every level, including undergrads. So that, I would imagine, whet your appetite to become a student here at ESF?
Absolutely. I still remember standing and looking at the quad with my dad, who is also an ESF alum, and him describing that you're not allowed to walk across it before we went up to meet Dr. Powell. And yes, I still remember my first moment walking through the doors of the molecular biology lab and feeling like, wow, I've found my place and what I want to do. And that absolutely led me to ESF to continue learning and growing as a scientist.
Wow, what a good spokesperson you will be for us. We got to get that out to the to the folks that are considering their college options. So what is your role then? You've spent all 4 years in Dr. Powell's lab?
Yes, I have. And in Linda's lab
Linda's
as well.
Lab.
I have done a little bit of everything. I started washing glassware and autoclaving transgenic waste, which is not as glamorous as what you see in National Geographic, but everyone starts somewhere. And over time, my role has really grown into being our database manager. So as Linda mentioned, we have orchards with wild type American chestnut trees out at Lafayette Road Experiment Station. And it's my job to keep track of around 5,000 trees that we're responsible for taking care of. And I work with our collaborators from Maine down to Georgia, who also have plots of wild American chestnut trees. And they send us nuts to grow at our orchards. And we keep track of all of their pedigrees and genetics and where these trees actually came from to try and preserve that genetic diversity that is
so important.
Yeah, so important for a restoration effort.
And I understand that you are going to head to grad school when you finish here. And I don't know how you are going to replace that work that we're getting from Kira. So please don't go far away.
Oh, no. And I don't think I'll be away forever.
Okay, good. That's good to hear. So you then came up with what was a blight-resistant seedling. And where does the story go from there?
Well, there's two things we needed to do. One, as was just mentioned, we needed to increase genetic diversity. Because when you make this from a single cell, make these trees from a single cell, basically you have clones. And you definitely don't want to use a clone for restoration. So we've been using those trees to outcross to surviving what we call mother trees, these wild trees that Kira just mentioned, and going through generation after generation to recapture that genetic diversity that's normally found out in the population. We've gone through that to four outcrosses so far, four generations. Our goal was five, so we have one more to go, and then we're pretty much going to be ready for restoration. But there's another trick there, and that is the methods we use are highly regulated by the U.S. government, as we do use genetic engineering. So we had to first go to the regulators. We did this way back in 2014, and this was totally new to them because they never worked with a restoration tree or plant of any kind. What they have done is always work with agricultural crops. So we had to first tell them that, well, we're trying to make a tree that we actually want to put back into the forest. And they're so used to having a crop that they're trying to keep on the field. But we actually want this gene to go out and rescue other trees. So we had to kind of get them thinking differently and show them that this is okay. So we worked with them a long time with that. And then we actually have submitted our application for the tree that we want to get out. It's called Darling 58. The Darling name comes from one of the TACF members who came to us asking us to actually do this, Herb Darling. These trees are going to be the ones that will be the first trees ever approved by the U.S. regulators. And there's actually three groups there. There's the EPA, there's the USDA, and there's the FDA. All these regulators have to approve these trees before we get them out. And our target right now is August of 2023 to get these to the public.
Out to the public. So I'll be able to go to a tree nursery and buy an American chestnut perhaps as early as next year.
And we actually have a workshop coming up next year to figure out how to go up from producing a few thousand of these a year to 100,000 or more a year of these trees. And that's where we're going to have to collaborate with nurseries and stuff like that to give them seeds so they can produce trees and get them out to the public.
And then you'll be able to plant an American chestnut on your own property. And the hope is that it will start acting like every other tree. And the chestnuts will drop and they'll seed by themselves and they'll be blight resistant. Do we know for sure that the chestnuts that are then going to be for the next generation of tree are also blight resistant?
Yes, because we've actually done this. And this is where we've gone through several generations of outcrossing. And the only reason why we can go through these generations so quickly, because normally a chestnut would take 5 to 8 years to mature enough to produce nuts. But we actually developed a method in the lab where we treat the seedlings with high doses of light, and we can actually have them form the male catkins that make the pollen in less than a year. And so we can actually take nuts that we harvest, put them in high light growth chambers, have them produce pollen, take that out the next year and pollinate more mother trees and keep going through generation and generation. So that was a big advance also that was developed right here at ESF.
I was wondering about that high light chamber. That's something that you had to develop in order to keep your research moving along?
Yep. And it's kind of interesting because you never know where serendipity comes into your research, because we actually developed that by having some visitors from the Forest Health Initiative come to our labs. And our initial trees, when we were growing them, were kind of tall and lanky, kind of whippy. And what he suggested is, well, increase the light and they'll make thicker stems. And so we tried that. But when we increased the light, we also found, again, by accident, that this also produced catkins. And we, as soon as we saw that, we said, oh, we have something here. And then we started optimizing those conditions.
To be able to take what is probably the most important tree naturally here in North America, decimated, and then you play such a significant role in bringing it back. And we're on the verge now of being able to plant that and people will just watch it spread. I want to go back now to where we started in the beginning and why it's important. I know that there has been fear along the way that I'd love for you to address. You know, when you go to the grocery store and you buy food, sometimes you'll see non-GMO and people don't want genetically modified food. How is your process different from the thing that people are afraid of?
Okay, so here's the interesting thing. It's not different, but people should not be afraid of those. And the reason why is because we are actually using a method that's more precise than the old methods. And in fact, chestnut's a great example because for the past 100 years, people have been making hybrid chestnuts. And when you make hybrid chestnuts, you're actually combining whole genomes, not just genes, but whole genomes from different species. And when you combine those, they really rearrange and mess things up in the genome quite a bit. And some weird things have happened from people making hybrids. Things like male sterility is a very common thing you see. There was a thing called internal kernel breakdown where 40% of the nuts would just disintegrate in the shells by certain combinations of parents. But with genetic engineering, you are not mixing these whole genomes. You're not having all those extra side effects. You're putting in precisely one gene, and that gene is conferring the trait that you want.
And it's a natural gene that's in the food. We take that material and we are adding it to the chestnut tree, and it's making all the difference for the chestnut tree to be able to resist this blight.
Right. And even the method we use, Linda described with the Agrobacterium transformations. Agrobacterium is a natural genetic engineer, and we live in an age of genomics. We're sequencing everything, and we're finding that probably about 7% of the plants in the wild have been genetically engineered by this bacteria. So these are already out there, not done by humans, but done by nature. I always like to say that scientists don't do new things. We kind of mimic nature.
Right.
We learn from nature. You know, nature's already figured these things out. And once we can figure out what nature figured out before us, then we're golden. Instead of being kind of random, we're kind of directing it.
And so how about, Linda, your time here? How long have you been here with ESF?
I actually am a Ranger School grad. I graduated from the Ranger School in 1999, and then I came to the college, and I started working on the Chestnut Project in 2000.
So you must feel the same satisfaction then that you're right on the precipice here of seeing this. So let's talk about the benefits of the chestnut tree. You have mentioned that it was a food source and that it was a source of income for farmers and that lumber is rot resistant. But there's an important part of the ecology in the forest that is missing because we lost the American chestnut.
Absolutely. I mean, they have been kind of displaced by oaks and hickories, but they're not the exact same tree, and therefore the forests have changed slightly. We actually did a study as part of the regulatory process where we fed leaves of chestnuts to wood tadpoles. One of our current postdocs, Andy Newhouse, did this. And what we found was that the wood tadpoles did better on the chestnut leaves than they did on other trees like beech or maple and others. So that even though the chestnuts were gone, they still have that genetic memory of, well, this is what our food should be. So it does provide this benefit to the environment that has been lost. And in fact, there are actually some insects that were so specialized on chestnut, when the blight went through, they went extinct. They've found that at least five species of insects went extinct with the chestnut.
And I know you know here, but the folks listening to this that aren't in the scientific world probably don't fully appreciate how much losing five insects can affect the entire forest ecology. So what did the squirrels and the other animals that were eating the American chestnut, when it went away, what did they start to eat?
one thing, when the blight went through, there was always this drop in populations because those trees weren't there. But as the oaks came back, they could eat acorns. And the thing about acorns is that they don't have a consistent crop. Oftentimes they'll have a really big crop one year and then another year they won't. And so, you know, it goes up and down, where chestnut was very consistent from year to year. But there is still crops out there, mass crops for wildlife, you know, so they're not all dying away. But chestnut would be a slightly better one.
That's the key point to make. Have you been able to follow that through and to see what effect it's had on some of the larger species in the forest?
Things like wild turkeys, they're numbers did plummet with the chestnut going down because they used to feed on that. But they're coming back. They're finding other sources of food. And you can actually see a lot of wild turkeys nowadays.
It'll be interesting to have a postdoc or a grad student then test with the turkeys the way you did with the tadpoles and to see what the nutritional value will be of that American chestnut when it comes back.
Right. So it's really interesting how, you know, the ecology has these webs that all kind of interlink. So let's say you brought the chestnut back. And if you had more of these nuts every fall, you probably have more rodents, okay? And it turns out that these white-footed mice actually eat gypsy moth larvae. And so if you have more of them, you're going to have more of these to eat the gypsy moth larvae, which will protect other trees. But on the other hand, if you have more of these rodents, you also have more ticks and therefore maybe more Lyme disease. So there's always this interaction between everything that's going to be very interesting to see what happens when these come back. But it's not going to happen fast. I should mention that chestnut's not a weed. It will not spread quickly. This is restoration is what I call a 100-year project. And so this is a project for our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren.
I gotcha. So I was reading a little bit about your work. And can you talk a little, one of you, about the biomass potential of the American chestnut tree?
So the American chestnut is a very fast growing tree. You know, when it's, I say, released in the forest because of the open canopy, it can grow, you know, 6-7 feet in a year. It can grow up to an inch in diameter a year. Of course, its wood is very rot resistant, so it locks that carbon in for long periods of time. It has a very extensive root system, so it can put a lot of that carbon underground. And there have been some people who studied it, and it seems to be as good or slightly better than any of the other hardwoods.
And then there's also something about the conditions that it can grow in that are different than some of those other fast-growing trees like the willow.
Chestnuts have certain habitats they prefer. They love slopes. They can grow in very rocky ground, and they do like kind of acidic soil. So there's certain places they'll grow that the willow will not grow. And they're more tolerant to the more drier conditions than like willow would be.
So it's complementary.
Yes.
They're not going to fight with each other. They want to be in different places.
That's right. Yeah. If you're thinking about, you know, planting trees for carbon sequestration, you actually have to do a lot of different trees because they have different habitats and they're going to benefit being planted in different places.
When I hear you talk about some things, I think of the conversations I had with faculty that are kind of coming at this from a different direction and how everything intertwines here at ESF because our mission is so specific. You know, so I'm sure there are other faculty that are interested in that. And when they have the opportunity to compare that to some of the research that they're doing on other trees, this is going to be fascinating. So do you think that we're going to be able to take what you all have learned and apply it to other trees that we've lost? Are you going to be leaving a roadmap for people who want to restore a tree in the future?
Absolutely. And that's actually one of the things that I want to do before I retire is actually establish a tree restoration center here at ESF so we can take all the things we've learned with chestnut and apply it to other threatened trees. We already are doing that with some of the ones that are more closely related. We actually got some of our first samples from ash trees just a week or so ago. And we're trying to get those in tissue culture. I don't know if, Linda, do you want to say anything about that?
Hannah Pilkey and I went out to Dave Amberg's house about 2 weeks ago, and we collected some shoots from his tree. He has two or three ash trees on his property, and most of them have been devastated by the emerald ash borer, but he has one that's growing that's not affected, and it looks great. So we took some samples, and we're going to try to put them in tissue culture.
What is tissue culture?
Plant tissue culture is taking plants from the outside world and putting it into a container with a growth medium and sterilizing it so there aren't any microbes, and it has everything it needs to grow. It has nutrients, it has humidity, water, so they grow really quickly and they don't have to worry about competition.
And what will you be looking for in those samples you took from Dave Amberg's property?
We're going to start by growing it in tissue culture and seeing how they grow. We want to develop a system, and eventually, if we need to develop a transformation system for it, we'll have the samples.
So I just want to say, for the tissue culture, I mean, when we say we grow them in there, we're actually multiplying shoots. So you can start from one little shoot that you've taken off the tree, and you can make a whole forest in a jar. So you get, you know, go from one shoot to thousands of shoots, and each one of those could be rooted and make a separate plant. And those are the ones that we use for our experiments.
And that's what's planted at the Lafayette Experimental Station that you go to. Is that right, Kira?
Yes. So we have a lot of clones straight out of tissue culture. But then as we get these subsequent generations from outcrossing, we also have all of those planted. The clonal trees we call our T0 trees. And then each subsequent generation is T1, T2, T3, and so on. And like Dr. Powell said, we're trying to get to that T5 generation. And we have almost a living history of all of the different genetic events and transformations that have led us to the Darling 58 out at that Lafayette Road Field Experiment Station. And in addition to that living history, we also have experiments where we are looking at growth in a forest setting versus an open field setting. And we have common garden experiments that are replicated at other universities in Virginia and Pennsylvania and Maine. So sort of throughout that natural range of the American chestnut, we look at not just those clonal trees that came from tissue culture, but also all of the offspring to ensure they're behaving the way we expect them to with the blight resistance.
It sounds like there's an unlimited amount of research that can be done on the various aspects of this whole project. So you are headed to grad school, and are you going to continue to study the American chestnut?
I am not necessarily planning to continue studying the American chestnut, but I'm going to Penn State University, and my hope is to work with researchers at the Schott Center for Tree Molecular Genetics and learn more about how we can incorporate genetic diversity and preserving genetic diversity into these larger restoration plans.
There can't be a student that's going to start with you that will be coming with as much experience and knowledge as you're going to be starting with. So I wish you well with that. So, Bill, tell us about where you are in the process of approvals from the federal government. You said there's three agencies or four that you need approval for.
Yeah, so there's three in the United States, and then we have actually two in Canada, because we'll probably be going up to Canada also, since the range of the chestnut goes into Canada. So the first one we submitted to over 2 years ago was the USDA APHIS BRS, all their initials there. And they've been reviewing our trees, looking at what they call plant pest risk. And they actually have that evaluation done, but they also have to do an environmental impact statement. And so that's still going on. And that's the one that we hope to have finished by August of 2023. All these things also have open comment periods, so the public can always chime in. And mostly it's been very positive, which is great. So we've had that with USDA. The EPA, we've submitted for getting close to a year now, and they look at the environmental aspects of the chestnut restoration. And we're doing very well with them so far. And they've sent us two letters, 10-day letter, and then a 75-day letter where they ask questions and you have to respond in that amount of time. The FDA has a much narrower view. They're just interested in food and feed. And that's the shortest one, actually, because all we have to show is that, you know, this is not an allergen. It's not a toxin. You know, there's nothing harmful about it because it's found all over the place anyway. But we hope to have them all wrapped up at the same time in fall of 2023.
And we'll have a big celebration here.
That's what I hope. Yes.
Okay. I'm in. So just recently, your work was the subject of an article in National Geographic.
Yes. We've been on their website a couple times before, but this is actually the first time in the actual magazine, which was great. So in the May issue of National Geographic, they have a section on four remedies to save trees, and we're one of those four. So that's wonderful. We recently got a short mention also on Good Morning America.
That's really great for the college because we get talked about a lot as a hidden gem, and we don't really want to be hidden. We want to tell the world about what's happening here. I know in the scientific community, we're not hidden because there's a lot of interaction between researchers at this college and other colleges. So what's next for you, Linda, when we get to the approvals and we're starting then to put these plants out in the public in the fall of 2023?
Oh, there's always going to be something to do. There's other tree species that are battling some kind of issue. So there's always going to be a tree that needs help. And we're trying to become a tree restoration center. So we have American elm, we have the ash we're starting with.
I look at the pictures from the house I grew up in, and right along the park, I grew up on one of the city parks in Syracuse, there were the whole row of absolutely beautiful elm trees. And when I look now, they're all gone. And that was what we referred to as Dutch elm disease. There's probably a more scientific term for it, but we lost all those elm trees. And it's great to think that we can have a tree restoration center here that can then continue its work. And unfortunately, I think there'll be an unlimited amount of work. But what's most important is that you've really put a blueprint together that gives a giant head start to researchers in the future. How about for you, Bill? What's going to happen when this day comes and you have all of these approvals and you're moving toward 100,000 trees and you're making them available to people in the public?
We do want to broaden this out. It took us a long time to build up the infrastructure as well as the skills and knowledge base in all our team. We have typically around 30 people working on this project every year, everything from high school students up to postdocs. And we have colleagues at a lot of different universities that work on this. So we want to make sure we don't lose this knowledge. So there's a publication recently that stated that we could lose up to 40% of our forest biomass just to about a dozen pests and pathogens that have been introduced into this country. And so there's going to be lots of opportunities to try to save our forests, especially when we want to use these forests to sequester carbon. We can't be planting trees and at the same time losing trees to these pests. So we want to make sure that we have trees that are resilient and resistant to these challenges.
And the first one is always the most difficult. And you're doing that. And I hope then as these pathogens come and our species of trees start to have new threats, that we will, as a public, be more able to more quickly respond and maybe not have to decimate the entire population of trees the way we pretty much have with the American chestnut before we enter with a solution. So I'm just going to end with this, and I kind of want all three of you to answer the same question. So Linda and Bill, you have a minute to think. Kira, you have no minute to think.
Perfect.
What's the thing that you would like the public to know about this project?
Well, first, you mentioned the enthusiasm, and that goes so far beyond just the researchers involved at ESF and other colleges. Everybody has a chestnut story. And one of my favorite things is when we give tours to the public of our field stations, people cry seeing all of these American chestnut trees in one place. And as you mentioned, you grew up with chestnut trees and you grew up with elm trees lining your street. Everybody has a story like that. So the enthusiasm extends to every corner of the country to some extent. And the one thing that I would like people to know, I would say that it's not something to be scared of. And the best thing you can do is ask questions and learn more about it, because you're only scared of things that you don't know anything about.
Well said. How about you, Linda? What's something that you would like the public to know about the work that you're doing?
I just want them to know that we spent a lot of time on this. It's not something that we just came up with and are putting out there. We've researched this. We've done a lot of work on it. We've tested this. It's 39 years of research, so it's not something that they should be scared of.
I think that's a really important point. It's been 39 years that we've been working on this, and we've yet to get the final approvals and yet to make the tree available to the public. So they should take some reassurance from that fact. And how about you, Bill? We'll give you the last word.
Well, first, I want to say that this has been such a great honor to be on this project. I have colleagues who say, you're so lucky you're working with such a charismatic tree. And that's true because no other tree probably could have gone through this process. You know, it's because of the love of the public for this tree. I mean, how many trees have a song written about it? Chestnuts roasting on the open fire, right? I'm so grateful that we could start with the chestnut, but I do want to emphasize that this is just a beginning. The chestnut is the icebreaker. We're building a path forward, and we want to try to apply this to save other trees. We're interested in the environment, and there's a lot of challenges out there, and we want to be able to meet those challenges.
And ESF is the place where the solutions are being created. And I hope that you know how much appreciation we have at the college for the work that you're doing. We're really lucky that you're doing that work here. And I just hope that you have a lot of satisfaction when you imagine the impact that you're going to have on the landscape in our country. So thank you so much for taking time to sit and talk to me and to talk to us and to teach us a little bit more about the American Chestnut Project.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That will wrap season 2 of the Campus Conversation, the podcast, hearing about some of the great research that's done here at ESF. There's lots more to talk about, and I'm looking forward to season 3. I want to thank Tyler and Jason for the work you've done producing and editing this podcast. We will be back in the fall and hope to have more conversation then. Thanks.